7 in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. From modest beginnings in military radios, the British firm Vodafone became an enormous global telecommunications brand, hoovering up other businesses left and right. Now, it's having to sell them off in order to get itself back to its former health. And Britain has an enviable record in keeping its cherished old architecture from being modernized or knocked down, thanks to a process called listing buildings. A certain irony, then, that system is a tangled bureaucracy that needs updating. First up, though. The Dow Jones Stock Market Index, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, they all hit record highs yesterday. Why? Just a few words from this man.
Inflation has eased substantially, while the labor market has remained strong. And that is very good news. But inflation is still too high.
Jerome Powell, chair of America's Federal Reserve, announced at the central bank's quarterly meeting that he would not cut interest rates. But he hinted, just hinted in a central bankery kind of way, that cuts were coming.
If the economy evolves broadly as expected, it will likely be appropriate to begin dialing back policy restraint at some point this year.
The rate at which he held once more was first set last summer, the highest it had been in more than 20 years. Yet still, the American economy keeps screaming along. The question is how Mr. Powell can ensure a gentle end to this cycle.
The big news for the U.S. economy at the start of this year is that growth has been a lot stronger than expected.
Simon Rabinovich is our U.S. economics editor.
Ever since the Fed began to really aggressively tighten monetary policy, you know, raising interest rates from a floor of 0% to 5%, the expectation was that growth would slow sharply, if not careen into an outright recession. And yet virtually every step of the way, economists have upgraded their forecasts. Going into this year, expectations were that growth would slow to about 1%. So far, it's tracking to be somewhere north of 2%.
Well, what's actually going on here? Why is the American economy performing so well?
Several different factors play into it. Number one, there have been a lot of buffers in the economy that were built up during the pandemic, the post-pandemic period, and that has allowed everybody from households to companies to governments to endure the monetary tightening of the past couple of years. You know, typically, when rates go from 0% to 5% overnight, you'd expect that to lead to much slower growth. What in fact has happened is that households, companies locked in quite low interest rates on a medium to long-term basis. And moreover, they had built up really, really big savings during the pandemic. And that has given them a really ample cash cushion to ride through this period of monetary tightening. There's other factors as well. You know, for example, if you look at the energy sector, that's been a big headwind for Europe because gas prices, heating prices, you know, went up quite sharply in 2022, continuing into the start of last year. The U.S. is a big energy exporter. Its energy prices have been a lot lower. And in fact, it's seen benefits because it's gained so much money through exports of crude, exports of natural gas. And fiscal policy itself has still been quite stimulative. Last year, the fiscal deficit was about 7% of GDP. So all of these things have come together to make for very, very robust U.S. growth.
Well, with all due respect to the economists, though, Simon, shouldn't all of those factors have been kind of apparent? Shouldn't this not be a surprise?
people could see all of these things, but the belief was that they would begin to be used up fairly quickly. So another example, because of all of the fiscal stimulus at the height of the COVID pandemic, households had a lot of excess savings to the tune of roughly $2 trillion. Very smart analysts at the San Francisco Federal Reserve Branch tried to estimate when all of those excess savings would be used up. At some point last year, they thought they would be done basically in the middle of 2023. By the end of last year, as new data came in, they said, well, actually, maybe they will last until the middle of 2024. So people could tell the general story, but in terms of the details of how it all fits together and what the data actually looks like, that's where there has been a big capacity for upside surprise.
So how to figure in all of these variables then with what the Fed has done? It's standing firm. What's the intent here?
Well, the Fed's goal is to deliver a soft landing for the economy. So what's a soft landing? It's number one, bringing inflation down to its target of 2%. Number two, it's beginning to lower interest rates to a level that's not so restrictive. Because although US economy has been very strong, if interest rates were lower, it would be even stronger. The third point is that it hopes to do all of this without having a big increase in the unemployment rate. But as far as the Fed is concerned, it used to describe the path towards a soft landing as being extremely narrow. Given the way that inflation has slowed and the economy has remained strong, the general belief is that the path towards a soft landing looks a lot wider than it did a year ago. So that the big question this year is, when can the Fed start cutting interest rates? Can it do so in such a way that inflation doesn't just have a massive resurgence? And that's the needle that it's trying to thread.
And so do we have a sense for how it's going to thread that needle when the cuts may come?
Every quarter, the Fed gives us outlook about what it's going to do with monetary policy and how it views the economy developing. And going into this year, it had said that it would cut rates 3 times. Well, at the start of this year, January and February, inflation was too high for comfort for the Fed. And so many people had thought that this week, the Fed would say, rather than cutting rates 3 times this year, it'll cut rates 2x this year. But in the end, the Fed actually is staying the course. It says that it's still going to cut rates 3 times this year. It doesn't say when it's going to start. The market generally believes it'll start cutting rates in June. But the big kind of headline outcome from this week's meeting is that the Fed still believes it's headed towards 3 rate cuts. And I know that sounds like a small difference, 2 versus 3 rate cuts, but it's really quite significant because what it means is that the Fed is looking at the high inflation readings in January and February and saying that actually there was quite likely a lot of seasonality, a lot of one-off factors involved in those high inflation prints, and that though it sees the path as being quite bumpy, it still believes that the economy is on course to having good gradual disinflation, which does open up the door for it to cut rates.
Given how many parts of this story so far arise because people didn't see coming what eventually came, what are the ways this plan could come unstuck, that the landing could be not quite so soft?
Well, to use the Fed's language, they talk about the idea that there's two-sided risks. In their view, there's the risk that they cut rates too early and that leads to inflation popping back up again. On the other hand, there's the risk that they're too late with cutting rates, and that leads to an excessive slowdown, a recession, a big rise in unemployment. I would say that the risks are tilted more towards the side of them being a little bit late with rate cuts. You could look at a variety of indicators right now that are, I would say, a little bit worrisome. Although consumers have excess savings, in large part, in fact, that's high-income consumers. Lower-income consumers have really burnt through their savings. Equally, if you look at the labor market, the unemployment rate has started to rise. It's still very low. The hiring rate by companies is well down. So the reason that the unemployment rate hasn't risen further is that companies are not firing workers. And part of that might stem from COVID. Everybody knows how tight the labor market was over the last couple of years. So a lot of companies might be hoarding staff right now. So I think there are a number of warning signs, and underlying all of this slowness is the fact that interest rates are very, very elevated. And as inflation slows, what that means is that in real terms, which is the gap between the nominal interest rate and the actual inflation rate, interest rates are actually getting higher, which means that they're getting even more restrictive for economic activity.
Again, with the pandemic stimulus stuff, just how many things are pandemic hangovers, both facts on the ground, bank balances for high earners, as you say, but also attitudes of hiring managers. The world is still living in that shadow in so many ways.
Yeah, I agree. It has scrambled the way that we live and work, right? It's still having a huge impact on every city's downtown core. People are still buying, you know, more goods than they used to. There's a degree of revenge spending on services, on travel, that's still working its way through the economy. In some ways, that makes the job of Jay Powell and the Jay Powells of this world harder, and that they're really in uncharted territory. There's no parallel, really, in the last 50 years that they could easily consult. On the other hand, you could say it makes their jobs a little bit easier, and that the only reason that they've been able to deliver the incredible tightening that they have without crashing the economy is because of all of these one-off pandemic-related factors that are continuing to filter through the economy. So, you know, it's really, I think, been a little bit of a curse in terms of clarity for central bankers, but a blessing in terms of being able to see growth sustained despite tightening.
Thanks very much for joining us, Simon.
Thank you, Jason.
What do resilient, sustainable, and high-performing supply chains have in common? They are all powered by GEP software. Built on GEP Quantum, the AI-powered, low-code software platform for procurement, supply chain, and sustainability, GEP software helps market-leading companies worldwide achieve breakthrough performance and results. GEP, helping the world's best companies do better. Visit GEP.com.
Cast your mind back to the year 2000, or if you weren't around then, just imagine it. Mobile phones, cell phones, had been democratized, had become affordable and small, and the company connecting lots of them was Vodafone.
Yeah. Hey, jeez, my phone!
Can't get a phone to work here, mate.
I can with Vodafone!
This British telecom became a global giant. In ad campaigns, superstar footballer David Beckham, in all his youthful coolness, was the brand's silent hype man. But now, in 2024, Vodafone doesn't quite have as much capital, cultural or otherwise.
At the start of the century, Vodafone was worth more than Apple. Back then, Vodafone had a market capitalization of around $152 billion. Apple was valued at $16 billion at the time.
Vinjeru Nkandawire is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
Flash forward to today, and Apple is worth $2.6 trillion to Vodafone's $24 billion. In just over two decades, a huge chunk of Vodafone's value has been wiped out.
Well, how? What went on behind the scenes during that time?
A lot of Vodafone's woes are self-inflicted. Analysts I've spoken to have criticized its history of acquisitions. Vodafone expanded into lots of different countries and faced specific challenges in different countries. It simply couldn't keep up with competition. On top of that, Vodafone has fallen short on many basics. It's had poor customer service over the years, although that's improved slightly. And it was slow to bundle broadband and streaming services in its European markets. But ultimately, the company's failed to cash in on considerable demand for mobile and internet services. Data traffic has also exploded, and it continues to rise. And these are essential services. Yet we now make calls on WhatsApp, we share photos on Snap or Instagram, and we broadcast videos on platforms like TikTok.
So part of that is Vodafone shooting itself in the foot, but part of that is just the world changed around it, right?
Yes, so all telecoms firms have struggled against online services like WhatsApp. The European industry in particular has struggled to make money. That's down to fierce competition, squeeze margins, and costly infrastructure rollouts. So for European telcos, the average revenue per user was around $16 in 2022, compared with nearly triple that amount for American operators. As a result, investment in 5G networks in Europe trails the amount in other regions. America, Japan, and South Korea have near universal 5G coverage, whereas in Europe, around 80% of the population had access to superfast network speeds at the end of 2023.
So is this a tale of terminal decline, or is there a means back for Vodafone?
Well, Vodafone is trying to get back on track. Last year, it appointed Margherita Della Valle as CEO, and she's been at the company for 3 decades. And her focus is on simplifying the group structure. Vodafone is shedding unwanted international assets. The company has agreed to sell its Italian arm to Swisscom, and last year it sold its business in Spain. Over the years, it's left America, China, it's cut ties with France, it quit Japan and New Zealand, and it might abandon Australia too. Piece by piece, Vodafone is dismantling its once sprawling empire, and that leaves Germany and Britain as its main markets.
So if acquiring too much stuff along the way was a problem, is shedding that stuff now starting to fix the problem?
Not quite. The company's performance is still lagging behind its European counterparts. Shares in Vodafone have plunged by more than a quarter in the past year. This compares with declines of less than 1% at Orange and gains of 3% at Telefonica. But now Vodafone is pinning many of its hopes on a merger with Three, a rival mobile network in Britain.
And so to your mind, is that then going to be the fix?
The deal has to get past the Competition Markets Authority, which is the British competition regulator. It's conducting an initial investigation into the transaction, and the deadline is Friday. On top of this, Vodafone is cutting around 11,000 jobs, which is more than a tenth of its workforce, all while trying to maintain generous dividends for its long-suffering investors. So while plans are underway, I don't see it rivaling Apple anytime soon.
Vinjeru, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
When I first started at The Economist, we were in a building everyone called the Tower. I remember one time when I first started, there were some people outside as I left work taking pictures of it. They were architecture nuts. They had come to see this masterwork by a superstar architect couple from the 50s and 60s who had designed this thing. My impression was that it was, with all due respect, it was a little bit on the shabby side. It had its problems. Before The Intelligence, we did podcasts in what I guess you could call a studio in the basement. It smelled a little of damp. There was a door that we definitely didn't go through that was marked asbestos. The hallways were narrow. The air conditioning ducts were under the windowsills, so when we all crammed into the editor's office for weekly editorial meetings, frankly, you froze your bottom. It just started to feel like a place that was not entirely fit for purpose anymore.
The old Economist Tower was quite a nightmare to manage, and a lot of that comes down to the fact that it's a listed building.
Caitlin Talbot writes about Britain for The Economist.
To change things like those awkwardly placed air conditioning units, you need permission from Historic England. In fact, you need permission to change practically anything. In 2016, the building managers had to get permission to clean the front of the building. Buildings like the Tower are listed as being of special architectural or historic interest. And it's a criminal offence to alter them without permission. The list, which is administered by Historic England, the government's heritage watchdog, is about 500,000 buildings long. And for many, it's nothing more than a nuisance. So in Norfolk, mobile phone signals are notoriously patchy because masts can't be built near listed buildings. And in Starcross, which is a seaside village in Devon, the columns of a listed pub obstruct the road, causing several traffic jams a day. So the Tower isn't the only building that's being affected by its listed status. Managers are finding headaches up and down the country with older historic buildings. The Oxford University Museum of Natural History is a good example. It has a spectacular glass roof, but that roof has long proved troublesome. In its 160-year history, the roof has collapsed once, partially blown off twice, and leaked constantly. All the while, it has poured masses of sunlight onto the natural wonders within. If you look at displays, you'll find red butterflies are bleached white, and the skins of stuffed creatures slightly cracked. The roof is a spectacular piece of architecture and rightly protected by law. But it also makes the building effectively a very large greenhouse. As the roof gets older and the world outside it warmer, preservation of the building and the things within it will only become harder. As inconvenient as it can seem, the listing system protects heritage. It safeguards architecture in places like Oxford, which has buildings that date back to the 11th century. It seems sensible that the museum had to submit an application to add UV blocking stickers to the roof because that was a large project that involved work over a year and taking off each tile individually. But the problem is that listings often include parts of buildings that weren't made to last, like a shelf or an air conditioning unit. The museum finds itself asking permission to paint the walls of a storeroom that no one sees or to change a fence on its front lawn. That also slows down routine fixes. So a project to replace the dodgy handrails on the museum staircase could take a year and a half. Applications to delist a particular room of a building must be approved by the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. In more than 99% of cases, they simply follow the advice provided by Historic England. But not always. In 2022, Nadine Dorries, then Culture Secretary, went against the advice of Historic England to add to the list a controversial plaque about Cecil Rhodes, which can be found near his statue at Oriel College. The trade-offs between heritage and modernity are real, but those trade-offs would be easier to manage if the list was less bureaucratic and more up-to-date.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. I'm being gently pressured into reminding you that you should probably take our survey, especially if you listen to us here on The Intelligence and haven't yet subscribed to Economist Podcasts Plus. The answers to just a few questions are going to help us make it all better. So come on, do me a favor. Thanks, and see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.